Good evening, everybody. Shmuel Plotzer coming at you live from Goldman's Synagogue and our School of Jewish Studies here in Cincinnati, Ohio. Huh? Not bad, right? Does that sound like a guy on radio with the small print, reading the small print? Okay. I don't think he could have said that any faster, but I will try. At all events, First Kings, that's what we do on Tanakh Tuesdays. That's why we're here. We're studying the Bible. Chapter 11. We're very much involved in it. It's been exciting. Solomon has got many wives. They're directing his heart away from God. They are serving false gods. They're worshiping gods and they're sacrificing to the gods, and it's crazy. And Solomon is allowing them to do that, and God's holding him on the hook. He's holding Solomon liable. Solomon himself, the rabbis want to argue, did not worship idols, but he let his wives do it. Meanwhile, there's a verse over here that says that he went after those idols too. What shall I do with that verse? Nobody even wants to touch it in the Talmud. They almost act as like it's not even there. It's really very, very amazing to see that. And at all events, we're in chapter 11, and we are learning that God is going to rip away the kingship from Solomon and give it away to two different people. One, the son. And that sounds fair, because that's following in the Davidic dynasty, David, Solomon, Rehoboam. That's going to be the son's name. Okay, good. But then there's also going to be Yerubbaal ben Nevat. And Yerubbaal, he is going to turn out to be a baddie, and he's going to be the king of the north. The king of the north. Doesn't that sound like some kind of welcome? How are you feeling? All right. The king of the north is going to be Yerubbaal ben Nevat. Sweetie, would you like to sit next to Andy and let Mrs. Burlow maybe sit in that chair? Anywhere you like. Okay, you good? Great. So, ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, that's sort of an introduction. Also, we must not forget that God has sent adversaries to Solomon to punish him for this craziness. And their names are Hadad, and then there's a guy named Rezon. And they're going to be thorns in the side of Solomon for the end of his life. He's going to have to deal with these characters. And one is in Syria. Rezon is in Syria. And we're going to see a map. Amazing. My son Mendel over here likes to read Geronimo Stilton. Geronimo Stilton books are animated like mouse books, and they're published in Italy. And I don't know what to make of that, other than they're lavishly illustrated, lots of color, and the mouse goes back in time to various parts of world history. Well, if he's going to go back to the Vikings, and he's going to go back to the French Revolution, why not send him back to Solomon's time? Well, that's exactly what they're doing in one of the books. So we're going to see, it's going to be actually relevant for one of our psukim, we're going to see how they portray in the maps that they give you. They're going to show you Solomon and his reach and his rule, how it went into contemporary modern-day Syria, and it's just going to be fascinating. Well, then Mendel's giving it to me. Look at this. Okay, thank you, Mendel. You know what? Let's read a verse. Let's read a verse, and then this little thing from Geronimo Stilton. I know what you're saying. Shmuel Plotzker, you have now left your senses. You've lost your mind. You're introducing Geronimo Stilton into the study of the Bible. And I'll say, it's taken you a long while to come to that conclusion. It's a perfectly valid conclusion. I have lost my mind. But you know what? Anything at all that I find that's even remotely relevant, I'm going to try to show to you guys. Mendel here is showing me Exhibit B, how there was clothing and fashion in the age of King Solomon. I said, Mendel, is this how the Jewish mice drew? I mean, is this how they dressed Jewish mice back in the day? Is this what they looked like in ancient temple times? Mendel said, yeah, I mean, if that's what the book says.
Well, so, sometimes.
Right. It depended upon that Jewish mouse's feelings that day. Did he want to dress up, or did he want to just kind of go informal?
Well,
but these are, this is fashion. written accounts about clothing styles in the time of King Solomon are not available. But we might imagine that the clothes were similar to those in the areas surrounding his kingdom. And sure enough, it's got very much the Middle Eastern, theme to a lot of it. Lots of long robes in white, keeping everybody nice and cool. Thank you, Mendel, for that. Good. If you've got your Bibles, that's great. If you don't worry about it. I do some of the heavy lifting over here. Last week, we ended off on chapter 11, verse 27. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to send this back for a moment, just for a moment, a little bit of review. There's nothing wrong with it. Okay, we were introduced to Rezon. So I'm going to read in English to catch us all up for the narrative. I'm going to read verses 23 and 24 and so on and get us caught up. And then we're going to have a quick look at this cute little map of the of Israel and Syria. Verse 23. Now God did not just raise up Hadad as an enemy of Solomon to give him aggravation for the idolatry that Solomon was allowing in his court, but also a guy named Rezon. Rezon had been some sort of a slave or servant to a dude named Hadad-Ezer, who is the king of Tsova, contemporary Syria. Rezon was a servant of that guy, Hadad-Ezer. And what happened was Hadad-Ezer got into a fight, and David slew a lot of these guys. If I'm not mistaken, yes, David slew the enemy of Hadad-Ezer. And because Hadad-Ezer's army was just decimated, this guy named Rezon managed to flee, we read in a footnote on verse 24. And so Rezon, he ran away, and he was able to organize a battalion. They went to Damascus, where he and his men ruled over the city. And as he acquired more strength, he ruled alone over the entire country of Aram. And you take Aram and Tsova, and as we said last week, that's contemporary Syria. And we talked about Aram Tsova, Keter Aram Tsova, the crown of Aram Tsova of Syria was the Hebrew Bible, which was around for centuries until Nebuch, until the 20th century. Six-day war, roughly then, there was a riot, and the city in Damascus, and that was not Damascus, it was Aleppo. That was the city I was trying to remember. This Bible, bound-up Bible, which was so beautiful and authoritative, and it goes back 1,000 years, this was the treasure and the joy of the Jewish community in Aleppo, Syria. And the Muslims invaded the synagogue where it was, thank you so much, and they tore the shul up, and they also, I think, tore up the Bible. They tore up that chumash. So the Jews were able to manage to maintain some of it, but they lost some pages. And so as we said last week, some of it got to the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, which is probably the greatest repository of Jewish books in the world, and certainly in the top three. It's almost unparalleled what they've got. So they have the Keter Aram Tsova, the treasure, the jewel of Syria, this Bible that goes back 1,000 years, but it's not whole and complete because of the attack of local Muslim hordes against the shul. Long story short, it's a very sad story. And every time, as we said last week, every time scholars gather together and they talk to each other and so on, and maybe Syrians, they ask each other, do you have a page from the Bible? Do you have a page from the Bible? They're trying to piece it together. Sad story, but doing what we can. Some of it's there, not all of it, and it's just a very, very big shame. At all events, that's the reality of life. So, point is that this guy Rezon, he was in the north, in Damascus, in contemporary Syria, and our footnotes say over here that he detested Israel. He fought Solomon all the days of Solomon. Of course, that had to mean the very end of the life of Solomon, not when he was younger, because everything was hunky-dory early on in Solomon's life. Okay? He hated Israel, and there was a rebellion against David, and of course against, well, not exactly against David, but against Solomon. And because they had no desire to allow Israel to rule over them, these guys rebelled, and there were Jewish governors in Damascus at first, and then Rezon himself was ruling over Aram instead of Solomon's governors, and ultimately the Jewish people under Solomon said, enough's enough. There's no reason why we got to keep on fighting for these provincial outposts all the way north over here in Syria, and Aram Tzova. Let it be, let it go. So here is, thank you, Mendel, here is the Geronimo Stilton map. And you know what? I know you're laughing, but guess what, people? It's a map, okay? It's better than nothing. Now, I know you're going to say, are you for real? And I'm going to say, anything that shows us anything at all that can be illustrative of something is better than nothing. So, bless. The kingdom of King Solomon around 960 before the Common Era. It's a long time before the Common Era. To see Yerushalayim over here, we all are familiar with that. There's the Jordan River going down. There's the Sea of Galilee. There is the Yam HaKinneret, Sea of Galilee, right over there. And contemporary Israel kind of ends up over here, all the way up north, about over here. And that's where the Golan Heights kind of start. And there's Damascus, pretty close by. And there's Palmyra, way north of Damascus. And so this is contemporary Syria, as you can obviously see. But apparently, the kingdom of Solomon had extended to Damascus and well beyond. Wow! All the way up north, look at that, to the Euphrates River, to the very, very northern part of contemporary Syria. Let's read this footnote. Solomon was the third king of the kingdom of Israel and is often remembered for his wisdom and ability to govern. Under his guidance, the kingdom of Israel prospered. He organized the state in an efficient way, constructing numerous public buildings, developing commercial traffic, and establishing an important port on the Red Sea. Etzion Geber. There is the Red Sea, and he's got a contemporary Eilat all the way in the south. There's Petra. Look at that. I didn't think that Petra looks like Petra's part of Israel. Petra is in contemporary Jordan. Petra is contemporary Jordan, and Petra is famous. Why is Petra famous? It was the site of a very famous movie. Who can remember it? Very good, Indiana Jones and the something or other, okay, where he is, he's running away, and it's just a marvelous place that they filmed it in Petra, because I think the Nabataeans or something, they were the ones who made it, and they built like these idols into the walls, and oh my goodness, people, just Google Petra, P-E-T-R-A, and I think surely Indiana Jones will come up, and then watch that 7-minute clip from the movie, and you will be marveling at what that ancient tribe built so long ago, and you can see it today in modern-day Jordan. Okay, so this area was basically ceded, C-E-D-E-D, it was given back, it was handed over by the Jewish people over to Rezon. They said, listen, what are we going to fight about? It's so far north, forget about it. And that's more or less what happened. Okay, and we'll see that. Let me just make sure that I have a footnote for that. After Rezon's rebellion, Israel had no interest in reoccupying this land. David had conquered it. There's a dispute in the Talmud about the sanctity of it. But at all events, after Rezon's rebellion, according to Das Sofrim, I'm on page 127 in your Bibles, Israel, meaning under Solomon's rule, the nation of Israel had no interest in reoccupying this land all the way to the north, and they said, forget about it, and that stayed out of Jewish hands, it seems, from then on in. Okay, very good. Thank you, Reb Mendel. And there's more, obviously, because, you know, there's like I said, it's Geronimo Stilton, a book about a mouse, and so everybody is a mouse in Solomon's court, and you can snicker all you want, but kids get a kick out of this. And Mendel is trying to now show you. You can't really see it, if you're calling in. But for those of you who are lucky enough to be here live and get snacks, goodies, refreshments, drinks, and so on, you can also see that there are two different depictions of the Solomonic court. Mendel is holding one depiction, which you find in a book called No Navi. Okay, this is one way to look at Solomon's throne and palace. And this one is a second way. So there you have it. Did it look like Geronimo Stilton's way or this way? It's hard to know exactly. Either way, you know, looks pretty impressive. And animals and a big throne and the whole thing, it's beautiful. Strap Mendel, thank you very much. You should take pride. Mendel said, oh, I can contribute to my father's shear. And I always encourage something like that. So Mendel, a big Ishikaya, you should keep on boxing ice, you know, box ice on Talmud Chacham and keep on learning. And if Geronimo helps you along that way, who am I to say anything at all? Shkoyach Mendel. And now, without further ado, we're going to continue now. Okay. Quick review of verse 27. Chav Zayin, v'zeh hadavar asher harim yad b'melech. This is, we learned last week that Yeravam, he rebuked King Solomon. And this is why he did that. Shlomo bana es hamilo, sagar es peretz, ir David aviv. Solomon built up the milo, and for many the word milo itself means something that is malay, that is filled already. So he filled up that, he built something that was filled. We're going to see all this in the commentaries. But he closed up es peretz, ir David aviv, the breach, the hole, the opening, not the word breach, that David, his father, had developed in Ir David. Ir David, of course, is as we speak, it is a very densely populated Arab neighborhood in Yerushalayim, and it's to the south of the Kotel. And they're doing all kinds of great archaeological digs in the area, finding all kinds of fabulous stuff. And I think that I may have said last week that they found the steps, the Ole Regel, Derech Ole Regel, and Mike Huckabee walked along there. And that was a fascinating discussion, the discussion that we had last week. Okay, so Shlomo, he built up and closed up this breach that had been developed by his father. Let me just guess for a drink. A little pink lemonade. Thank you so much. Let's take a look at some of the footnotes. Why is it so bad? Thank you, Barry. Why is it so bad that Solomon filled up or rebuilt a breach or a hole that was existing in his father David's lifetime? What's the big idylla? Why is it so bad? If Solomon did that, why is he going to get rebuked? Thank you so much. Man, that is good. Turkey Hill, strawberry kiwi lemonade. Fabulous. Okay, here we go. What was the bad thing that he did? Why was Solomon rebuked by Yeravam? Please take a look at the footnote. We could read this either in Hebrew or English, but we'll keep it to the English at the moment. I'm on the bottom page, 127. On the right-hand page, underneath the all Hebrew text, verse 27. And this was the matter which Shlomo, that he was rebuked, that he built up the Milo. What does it mean? So Rashi writes, and with this building, Solomon closed up the breach behind the Milo. Yeravam rebuked Solomon, and he said to him as follows, your father David made holes, made breaches in the wall, so that pilgrims, Ole Regel, could enter Jerusalem. And you, now you got to skip over to page 128. And you fenced it in to create an angaria. That's the word that's used over here in the Rashi. Rashi uses the term angaria. So you got to bank that word in your head. What does the word angaria mean? Well, we're going to get a definition right now. You fenced in the whole area. It was open. Pilgrims could go there. People who had the mitzvah of being Ole Regel, of going up to Jerusalem for Passover, Shavuos, and Sukkot, they had room to go because this whole place, there were holes and breaches in the walls. It was awesomely great and made things easy for them. You filled everything up. You ruined everything, Solomon. Why did you do that? Well, there are some theories as to why he did it. We saw this about a month or so ago in chapter 9. So we're going to kind of revisit it, but that's That's our life. That's what we do. Little Chazara, you created an Angaria. And the definition of Angaria here, we're told, is a labor force, a group of people that'll do work for you. You created a whole bunch of people who could work for you. Excuse me, and specifically, they're going to work for your beloved wife, the daughter of the Pharaoh of Egypt. And you're stationing them there, and those are your manservants and maidservants. And now we understand why you did it, Solomon, because you wanted to create a staff of slaves for your beloved, especially beloved wife, the daughter of Pharaoh. You really like her. And you want her to have servants. So you created, filled up all the breaches. And by doing so, you created an area. Now, men and women who serve your wife can live over there and be at her beck and call. Shame on you, Solomon. Shame on you for doing that. That was the rebuke that this guy Yeruvim gave to Solomon. Problem is, footnote explains to us, and remember, we can't eat the entire box of ice cream, kids. I mean, I'm willing to be on the hook and owe the shul a box or two of ice cream. But remember that you can't eat the whole thing straight from the box, unless there's only a little bit. And this is the kind of conversations that we have. You can have, but like it says in John Mark's Bagels, but just be fair. Now, you can ask for a little more or a little less, but be fair. So remember, have a little bit. Put it into a cup. Here we go. Rashi is confronted by this very verse and its treatment in the Gemara and Sanhedrin, Babylonian Talmud Sanhedrin. Over there, he gives three different reasons as to why Yeruvim rebuked Solomon. Let's explore that. Rashi and Sanhedrin explains the statement in three alternative manners, none of which coincides with his commentary on Kings. Amazingly, the same man who's writing a commentary in the Book of Kings is confronted by that very same verse in the Talmud, and over there he gives three different explanations, as opposed to the one he gives over here. And that's really got to shake your head off. Wait, how can you do that? How do you give three different explanations and you don't even refer to the way that you explain it in your biblical interpretations on the Bible and Kings? What's up with that?
His wife wrote it.
Okay. Hold that thought. I don't know about that, but we'll see. The first explanation as to the rebuke that Yeruvim gave Solomon is why. Why did he let him have it? It's because David had made wide breaches in the wall to allow the pilgrims to enter easily. And Solomon closed that breach, and he forced all the pilgrims to enter by way of the gates, where they would have to enter one by one. One by one by one by one by the hundreds of thousands. Everybody comes in one by one by one by one by one. That's going to take forever. But it also enables you to what? Get some money. When you want to enter Manhattan, you're also coming into Manhattan one by one by one by one. If you're going to come into Manhattan, it's going to be either through the Lincoln Tunnel or the Holland Tunnel or the GWB, the George Washington Bridge, or some other way, and no matter how you get in, unless you're coming in by submarine, okay, you are going to pay a hefty toll to get into Manhattan. It's car by car by car. That's kind of like Rosh Hashanah, right? Hashem, according to Chazal, the Almighty, sits in judgment, and everybody is, it's like Kvakodesh Roe Edro, like HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the shepherd, and he's letting the sheep go in one by one by one by one by one, and everybody gets looked at. He's going to have an easy year. He's going to have a miserable year. This one is somewhat challenging year. This one ridiculously challenging. Everybody gets his judgment, one by one by one. You can get an idea about that when you drive into New York City. Over here, your Rebbe is saying, you closed up all those holes in the walls. You did that in order to make money off every single pilgrim, every single Ola Regel was coming. I had to come up to Yerushalayim, and for you, that was just a way to, I was a revenue creator. You're looking to make money, and you did it. Shame on you, Solomon. Yerubim rebuked him, claiming that he had done this in order to collect taxes from everybody entering. And for whose benefit? Pharaoh's daughter. And all these things, Pharaoh's daughter will benefit. In the explanation that Rashi offers in the Talmudical tractate Sanhedrin, Pharaoh's daughter, she's going to be benefiting every which way, according to these three very different interpretations. That was number one. Number two interpretation or explanation is that Shlomo closed all the gates of the city. That's how he built the Milo, and he closed off the gates. What does it mean? He closed all the gates. Near one of those gates, he built a tower for whom? You guessed it. His beloved. His immortal beloved. He loved her more than all his other wives, and he had 1,000. He liked this one best. He built a tower for his wife, Pharaoh's daughter. He left only this gate open where the tower was, thereby forcing all the Jews who were coming up to do the mitzvah of Aliyah L'Regel, who were being Olah Regel, they were coming up by foot for the Regalim, for the holidays. What are the three big holidays? Pesach, Shavuos, and Sukkot. Torah says you got to go up. They're going up, and Shlomo is Johnny on the spot to make some money off of them.
Okay,
like Mendel's saying, Jews are coming in from all over, from Rome, I don't know if they were living in Rome, but if they're living in Israel proper, they're coming up to Yerushalayim. If they're over here in modern-day Syria, before Rezon came along, must have been there were Jews living over here in Jewish-occupied country. They were coming south. Jews in the south are coming north. Everybody was converging upon Jerusalem. Thank you, Mendel. And Yerubim accused Solomon of doing all this to force the people to pay homage to Pharaoh's daughter as they passed through the gate. And guess what? That's another definition of the word angaria. I'm kind of giving it away. I'm like the guy I'm the guy at the Jack Casino. I'm dealing out the cards, and I think I just gave away my hand. The word angaria, for Rashi's purposes, here in Kings, means a labor force. But for Rashi, when he gives the interpretations in the Talmud, over there, angaria is going to mean, respect and tribute for Pharaoh's daughter. It's going to be given a different definition. And finally, a third explanation as to what it means that Solomon built the Milo and aggravated Yerubim and it aggravated all the pilgrims. What is the third interpretation? He locked the doors of the temple court and he kept the keys. How about that? How about you are the king, you just built the temple, and you are holding on to the keys of the temple? By the way, one at a time. Barry, you go first.
Had to wake him up and get the keys.
Thank you very much. We're going to be there exactly. We're going to be there in a second. Good. Mrs. Brunner, what do you got? What doesn't make sense? And then lock people out. True. Good point. Would John Marx, in his heyday, build a bagel shop and then not open it up at 5 a.m. so people could start with their work so you can be open for business at 6? Would John Marx wake up at 10 and everybody is clamoring, the workers got to get in, customers have got to get in, and John Marx is going, it's Sunday, baby. Baby, it's Sunday. I'm taking it easy today. I don't care what you guys have to do. I know I built this business, but listen, I sleep till 10. Mrs. Brown is going, that's the craziest thing anybody would ever do. You build a temple, then you let people who've got to do what they got to do their thing. Why are you interfering with that? Okay. Good point. By the way, isn't it the case that in contemporary times, where have I seen this? I think Lahavdil ben Tumala Tahara, to distinguish between holiness and impurity, the various Christian groups that make up those who live, and they do live, in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, in the Old City of Yerushalayim, they're like, they're at war with, they fight with each other, constantly fighting and fighting over who's got that inch, who's going to sweep that inch, who's going to take over, who's in charge of the bathroom, who's in charge of the roof. It's crazy. Catholics over here, Eastern Orthodox over there, Ethiopian monks are on top, and everybody is fighting and fighting the Russians with the Coptics and the Catholics and the Protestants. Don't ask. But who's got the keys? I ask you again, who holds on to the keys of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in the holy city of Jerusalem? I say to you, an Arab family. If I'm not mistaken, a Muslim Arab family, if I'm not mistaken, holds the keys to that church. And they've been doing it for centuries. Centuries, I say to you. Exactly. Okay. And yet, you can also understand why that decision would be made. Because to give it to a Christian of any particular kind of denomination would be an insane thing to do. Because that guy would be seen as favoring his particular group. And we can't have that. So even the Christians realize this has got to stop. When bad enough we're fighting on a regular basis and the Jews have to come. And the Jews have to come and stop the fighting. Now, that's exactly accurate. The Israeli authorities, every so often, whenever there's a riot in the church, the Israeli cops have to come because they're in charge. I mean, it's not like the NYPD is not showing up on the scene. This is Jerusalem. Israel's in charge of all Jerusalem. I have got to break the news to you. So when fighting goes on between the various 10 groups of Christian monks in that church, Jewish cops come to stop the fighting. Who's holding the keys to that church? An Arab Muslim. Because that guy we can trust. Because that guy doesn't have any dog in the fight. He's not Catholic. He's not Coptic Egyptian. He's not the Eastern Orthodox, Russian, Slavonic. You get the idea. He's not that. He's a Muslim. We can trust him. He's not going to favor anybody. So, Lahavdil min Tuma l'Tahara. The third explanation is that Shlomo locked the doors of the temple court and kept the keys. Since it was customary for kings, as Barry said, to sleep until 3 hours after daybreak, the Jews would have to wait until Shlomo awoke in order to commence the temple service. Can you believe it? Your Rebbe rebuked him for this. He said, who are you to do that? I know you're the king, but how do you do such a thing? Yeravam, who was going to inherit the 10 northern tribes, accused Solomon of doing this so that why? What's the point of all that? Why would Shlomo, he's the smartest man on record, got to have a good reason. I'm the dumbest guy on record, and I have reasons for the things that I do. Shlomo, the smartest guy, you bet he's got a reason. What's his reason? To pay tribute to Pharaoh's daughter in order to obtain the keys. So that the Jews would have to pay tribute to the Pharaoh's daughter, his most beloved wife, to obtain the key, in order to obtain the keys of the temple court. They would have to pay money. And by paying money, they'd say, okay, now that we paid money, now can we get the keys? Well, if you pay money, you get just about anything you want in life. So, of course, we'll give you the keys. I was telling over, who were we talking about? Talking about Jewish life in Arab lands. It wasn't so ay-ay-ay. It was not nearly as insane as being on the Christian lands for 1,000 years. But I think that the Muslims honor their commitments to the Jews. You pay a tax, we leave you alone. We'd like you to convert to Islam. We'd like that. But listen, we understand you're crazy. You're Jews. You feel obligated to do your religion. All right. So then you better know your place. You're second-class citizens, and you're paying us the dhimmi tax. Dhimmi. D-H-I-M-M-I. Maybe it's dhimmi. I don't know how to pronounce it. But you get the idea. Dhimmi, thimmi, you pay us the tax that second-class citizens pay. You don't show your face. You don't walk around with your face all proud. Your synagogues are not going to be built high up. They're always going to be lesser than our mosques. And you will know your place, and then we'll let you live. Do you understand? That's how it's going to be here in Egypt, in Morocco, in Babylonia, Syria, whatever the country, Tunis, Libya, you get the idea. You're living in Arab land, you know your place. Pay us money and we'll leave you alone. The Jewish people say, okay, we'll pay you money. And they were not killed. The Arabs kept their word. You don't hear about constant pogroms in the Arab lands for centuries like you do in the Christian lands. It never happened. I don't think it did. Because the Jewish people paid a lot of money, and for that, they got a service. They were left alone. So the Arabs kept their word. They were men of their word. They made money. You make money, you leave people alone. I get it. So over here, Mahavdil, the Jewish people had to pay tribute to Paro's daughter. They paid her the money. She then gave him the keys, and then they were able to open up the temple. Go figure. Now, the editors of the Bible over here are going to give us the difference between Rashi here in the Bible and Rashi over there in Sanhedrin. I basically already gave you the answer, the basic difference between Rashi's commentary here, okay, and his commentary where he says Angaria is a labor force. He wanted to have a whole, you know, place for the men servants and maid servants for his beloved wife. That's how he understands Angaria here in the biblical text. Okay? It's all about Angaria. Here in Kings, Rashi explains it as a labor force. That's why he explains the place of the Milo, which had prior to this been an open plaza where all the pilgrims could pitch their tents. Think of that. Where all the pilgrims could pitch their tents when they came to Yerushalayim for the three big festivals. Okay? Now suddenly, it's built up as a housing complex for the servants of Pharaoh's daughter. The Jews who had been coming for years and they had a place to pitch their tents and live in Jerusalem for a week, and no small thing. What if there's no room in the inn? Have you heard of that? No room in the inn. Got to go to the manger. There's no room. So where does a Jew go? He brings along his tent with him and his family. They pitch a tent and they're able to be protected from the elements. The heat. Mostly the heat. Maybe a cold at night, let's be frank. I mean, it can get very cold at night, too, so you got to have something. So they pitch a tent. Very good. And now that's been taken away from them. Solomon removed that thing, that whole area. Now there's no place to pitch a tent. They're going, what is this? Why'd you do that, Solomon? Oh, look at that. So he can have men servants and maid servants for his beloved wife, the Pharaoh's daughter. You can well imagine the disgust that the Jewish people felt. One minute they got a place to live for a week to do their mitzvah, and the next minute, no. Go ahead. Yeah. One of the miracles is that people always had a place to stay in Yerushalayim. Okay, so Mrs. Burloff, all I got is, I'm going to have to deal with that. All I got is they were furious at Solomon for taking away this particular location, but the Almighty in his great mercy opened up a different location for them, and that placated them, and their feelings were assuaged, and they were able to pitch a tent some other place. It is a pretty, thank God, it's a beautiful large area. So if not near this place, then that place. So the Milo didn't work out for them after a while. Because Pharaoh's daughter, she came first. She was the most important person in the whole cosmic universe of Jerusalem. That's how much he loved her. She was the most important thing. Unbelievable. Okay, so that's all I got on that one. Hopefully it makes some sense. Okay? And by building up this area, the gaps in the wall were closed, and the pilgrims could not enter through that side. In the Talmud, in Sanhedrin, Rashi defines the word Angaria as tribute, homage, tax paying. And that's why he explains it the three ways he does. Each one is another variant on the idea of paying respect and money to the Pharaoh's daughter. And there's a final version that appears in the Midrash, Leviticus Rabbah. Over there, get this, over there, we're told that King Solomon did not drink wine all during the 7 years, we read over here, all during the 7 years of the construction of the temple. He did not drink wine during the entire time that they were building that temple up. So when did he drink wine? When the temple was completed, he made a banquet in honor of the occasion. And I do believe that we read that. It was a big, beautiful thing. And there were thousands of sacrifices, and many people came, and it was a whole thing. Simultaneously, What do you think he did, Andy? Simultaneously, he throws a big party for all the Jews. And simultaneously, he throws a party for his beloved wife, the Pharaoh's daughter. That seems to be a running theme here tonight, ladies and gentlemen, the Pharaoh's daughter. He made a banquet, we're told, in honor of the Pharaoh's daughter, whose palace was also completed at that time. He had two projects. Much like Trump, he had many building projects going at the same time. And in New York, if you come where I'm from, you got the idea that Trump was able to get things done on time and within budget, and the city was always dragging its feet. It was always like, you know, taking extra time, but you knew that Trump was going to get his stuff done. He did, because I think he paid extra, and he was smearing people, and he was paying double time to the people to work, and they were, oh my goodness, getting paid all this money, and they worked hard for Donald Trump to get his hotels up and his apartment buildings up and the whole thing. Trump got his way because he paid money. All right. And on this occasion, the occasion of completing the temple, and of course, the building of the home for his beloved wife, he drank wine. And because of the influence of the drinking of the wine, what do you think happened, ladies and gentlemen? He didn't rise until the fourth hour after daybreak. He took his sweet time getting up that morning. The Midrash tells us that Yerovam brought 1,000 members of his tribe and rebuked Solomon in their presence. Do you remember what our rabbis say about that? On the one hand,
it was a great idea.
Yes, it was a great idea. He deserved to be rebuked. You don't sleep in for 4 hours on such an important occasion. Okay, if you're going to do stuff like this, you can't. It's Mendel's material. Go, please go play with other stuff. Thanks so much. Big Shekinah to you. We'll be in there soon. We'll play. All right? It's a good idea, like Barry said, but you must not do it in public. Being Mavayish and Barabim, you know, embarrassing him in public, not a way to go. While it's possible that Yerovam rebuked the king concerning these two matters, of course, the closing of the wall and the delay of the temple service, it's nevertheless, he says, difficult to correlate them like Rashi does. After all, let's be honest, he says, if the closing of the gates refers to locking the gate of the temple court, you can't really draw any kind of, he says, no contrast can be drawn between David and Solomon. You know why? There was no temple in David's time. Moreover, according to the Midrash, Solomon overslept only on one occasion, whereas according to Rashi, he did so every day. According to Rashi, he overslept every day. Wow. According to the Midrash, only one time. Good. We continue, as we basically have flogged that horse to its death. We now continue on to the next pasuk, 28. Vayish Yerovam Gibor Chayil. Yerovam. Ah, that man, he was a soldier, a warrior, a strong man. Vayar Shlomo Asanar, ki osei melacha. Who? Shlomo saw in that young lad that he was a doer of work. He was a hard-working young man. Vayafkeiro so lachol sevo beit Yosef. And he appointed him over all the hard work, sevo, burdens in the house of Joseph. And what does that mean, the house of Joseph? Well, I think we can probably figure out what it might mean. Who are the tribes who derived out of Joseph? Ephraim and Manasseh. We'll let Rashi say that to us. But yes, that's what's going on. He was very impressive initially to King Solomon. Ultimately, not so much. But initially, he was very impressive, and Solomon appointed him high up. Let's go take a look at some of the footnotes. Yes, Yerovam was from Ephraim. Thank you so much. He was from the tribe of Ephraim, and that would make eminent sense to appoint an Ephraimite to be in charge of matters referring to Ephraim and Manasseh, because he's from those tribes. So take a look, please. Okay, 28. And Yerovam was a mighty man of valor. Take a look at this footnote. Scripture goes back to relate to us. Now we're going to kind of go back and see what's the origin of this whole thing. Tell us a little bit about your rabbi. How did it come about that he rebelled against King Solomon? And what position did he occupy among the servants of Solomon at the very beginning? So Solomon saw prior to this, prior to all this aggravation, and Jeroboam was rebuking him in front of 1,000 people. But what was going on at the very beginning of Jeroboam's life? Tell us a little bit about that. Okay, the pasuk says he was a stand-up guy. He was a diligent worker. He was doing work, quick in his work, and very diligent. So says Rashi. See that in the Hebrew, 28. He was maher b'mlachto v'zariz, quick in his work and enthusiastic to get it done. Over all the burdens, I'll call Sevel Beit Yosef, over all the burdens of the house of Joseph, says Rashi, over all the taxpayers of the house of Yosef, so that's Targum Yonason. Rashi in the Rabag and the Matsuda says that it means he was over the Shvatim of the tribes of Manasseh and Ephraim, because he himself was from the tribe of Ephraim, as Mrs. Brother reminded us. 29. Vahi Vahisahi. So it was at that time, Yeravam Yatsam Yerushalayim, Yeravam left Yerushalayim, Vayimso so Achia Hashiloni, Achia the Shilonite, Hanavi, the prophet, met him, Baderech, along the way, for whom, now this is really interesting stuff, for whom Mitkaseh Basalma, Bisalma Chadasha, he was wearing a new garment. Who was wearing a new garment? Hold that thought. We don't really know yet exactly who was. When I was in Chappelle's, they always discourage us. You're learning to Gemara. He said, and he said, he said to him, he said to him. Then he said to him, and he said to him. Who's who after two lines? You don't know. So try to keep out those pronouns and keep it to real names. Who is wearing this coat? We're not sure. Maybe the prophet is. Ushneim levadam basadeh, and the two of them are in the field. Oh, who needs to know all that? What does that interest us? That one guy's wearing a coat, and the two of them are in the field. Are you for real? I need to know that? I mean, couldn't I know there was a prophet? And they talked. That would have been useful for me to know. But he's wearing a new coat, and they're in the field. I need to know where they are. Anyway, you know, it makes your head spin. So hold on to your head, because where do you hear the Midrashic take on it? First, the Pashup Shot. First Pashup Shot, 29. It came to be at that time when Yeravam left Yerushalayim. Why did he leave? The Rabag in the Matsuda says, to collect taxes from the tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh. He was a tax collector, and he's going to get some money. Well, then, you will leave Yerushalayim to go get the cash. You got to get the money to keep everything rolling. And Achia the Shilonite from Shiloh meets him, and he was wearing a new garment. So, of course, we have to know who was wearing the new garment. Was it Yeravam or the prophet? We're told over here it was Achia the prophet who was wearing a new garment. Since Achia tore the garment, we're going to learn in the next pasuk that he tore the garment. It was probably his own, since it's usual for the righteous to tear their clothing as a token of their grief over a rift developing in the kingdom of David. If you're a righteous man and you got a cloak on and you hear about terrible infighting, you express your grief by taking your coat and ripping it, showing your deep sadness over machlokas in Israel, over argument within Israel. That was the Radak on Ruth Rabbah, and also see Midrash and Radak, quoting also Midrash Shmuel. Now the two of them are in the field. They are and the two of them are in the field. There was no one with them who could reveal their activities, says the Abai Ben El and the Metzudah. There was nobody with the two of them who could reveal what they were doing. Now, the rabbis explain this verse homiletically. Here's the Midrashic take on it. And you know it's going to be a little bit out there. But that's why we learn it. I was reading about Midrash in general in the encyclopedia. And it can be like a free-for-all. I mean, it's not halachic. And therefore, you know, as long as you're not quoting heresy, we want to hear what you've got to say. We're open to your suggestions. How do you understand the pasuk? Take a look at this midrashic take. What does it mean? Yeravam left Yerushalayim. He left the register of Yerushalayim, which means he left the holy city and never to return to it, and never to have a share in the sacrificial service performed there, says the Gemara in Sanhedrin again. He left the register of people of Yerushalayim. One minute he was in Yerushalayim, the next minute, no! And never came back. The Aruch explains that Yerushalayim would never return with the righteous people in the hereafter to rejoice in the holy city. He doesn't seem to be having a place in Olam Haba. You're going to see why. So sad. This is the Midrashic take on these words. And the prophet was wearing a new garment. What does that mean, a new garment? That signifies that Yerubim's knowledge of the Torah was as clean and unstained as a new garment. Alternatively, they discovered chidushim, novel ideas in the Torah that no one had ever heard before. That's midrashic. That is a midrashic take on the word a new garment. Because he was the that Yerubim's knowledge of the Torah was as clean, right? So thank you, Mrs. Brill. Mrs. Brill is pointing out that midrashically this seems to be the case, that Yerubim was wearing the new garment. Whereas Pashat Pshat, plain and simple understanding, would lead you to believe that it was Achia the prophet who was wearing a new garment.
Maybe it could be both.
I don't know about both, because it's either one or the other. Remember what I said. Take what you hear and stick with that. The Midrash says, we lean towards Yerubim wearing the new garment. Pashat Pshat, we lean towards Achia wearing the new garment. But there was only one garment. And I don't think both of them could share it. It was just one garment, and it's either Achia's Torah, Yerubim's Torah knowledge, or it's Achia's new physical coat. Okay? Basodeh, there they are, the two of them in the field. What does that mean? That signifies that all the Torah scholars of their time could be compared to them as the grass of the field. These two, the prophet and Yerubim, were so outstanding in Torah knowledge. Everybody else was just grass in the field. These two men, our men right now that we're talking about, were the tall cedar trees. Everybody else was grass on the field. Alternatively, all the Torah's reasons were revealed to them as the grass of the field. Now watch this. This short dictum indicates the spiritual stature of Yerubim. Suddenly we now know who we're talking about. A great man. Not just any Pashat guy who comes along and got a big mouth and he starts screaming at the king. No. According to this, he was an outstanding Torah scholar. He could have been one of the greatest kings of Israel. Alas, his arrogance caused his downfall, as we shall see in the following chapter. Isn't it always like that? Great men with great potential and great ability. And what happens to them? They just lose their minds, and they get into arrogance, and they just forget how you got to be humble. And you don't scream at the king. If you're a Talmud Chacham, show a little respect to the king. A little bit will go a long way. Honest and true, it's unbelievable. And that ends verse 29. And it's 8:30. Sorry that we started a little bit late, but we got something done. We saw some midrashim. We knocked down two psukim, which is more than we usually do. Or at least it's more than we did in years past. As Mrs. Brill likes to say, man, we are flying through this. And the fact is, we kind of are. So God willing, next week, let's pick it up as we continue our study of the Tanakh. And we're going to pick it up at verse 30, Mitzvah Shem, next week. And we're going to try to make a really hard attempt at completing the chapter. To the extent that we can, we'll do whatever we can. I know we have a lot of psukim left in it, but we're getting close, ladies and gentlemen. For 13 more psukim, we're going to try to do it. Thank you so much, everybody, for coming out. It's 8:30 Eastern time. Have a great evening. Have a great week. And enjoy, with God's help. Those of you who join us for Midrash class, we'll see you then, Sunday morning. Those of you for Rav Cook's class, Monday afternoon, we'll see you then. those of you who tonight, Tuesdays, we'll see you back here next week. Shmuel Plotzker signing off for the Gofman Synagogue School of Jewish Studies here in Cincinnati, Ohio. Thanks so much for joining in. Have a good night and a good week. Take care, everyone. Good night.